Okay.
Just an attitude of self-righteousness and I'm right, you're wrong, hypocrisy, virtually. And these candidates go off to candidate school where I think their brain is sucked out and mush is pumped in. It's really, really a sad thing for the nation.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. If you look at the House of Representatives today, there's no interaction between the two parties on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was...
We were talking about politics and how modern-day politicians frequently in Washington are don't cooperate beyond the let's say Florida House or the Senate.
Right. And there it's very contentious.
Mm-hmm.
We, as a member of the Michigan legislature, I think, by the way, the same mentality carries on in the Michigan legislature as in the Congress. I
mm-hmm.
think politics have become extremely confrontational. And it isn't just a contest of ideas, but it becomes a contest of, in several people's minds, of right versus wrong, and they're right, and the other people are wrong, not just philosophically, but morally as well. They interject this question, this issue of you're evil, your views are destructive mm-hmm. to our society, and. They put it on a very personal level, which it ought not to be, because there isn't that clearly defined roadmap to goodness and to, shall we say, salvation.
Mm-hmm.
But they make it that way, and that's their principal failure.
Mm-hmm.
They think that politics is mortal combat and you have to kill your opponent. It's very sad, mm-hmm. very sad.
You think term limits have made that worse?
I don't know that term limits have made it worse. I strongly oppose term limits. It's ridiculous to place, for the citizenry to place a limitation on their right, who they want as their elected representative,
mm-hmm.
senator, governor. It makes little sense to me. It was one of those things that the right wing got enthused about. The media kind of liked it because it was controversial. It was something quote unquote new, and it was not nothing that they examined in any depth, of course, not that they do anyhow,
mm-hmm.
but nothing that they looked at from a serious philosophical standpoint,
mm-hmm.
or it never would have passed,
mm-hmm.
of course. I think the people are beginning to understand that term limits isn't the way in which you correct the wrongs of the system. The biggest wrong in the system, of course, is financing.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's prepared to really address that question. A lot of talk about it. I think in the Congress they're moving in the right direction. They have certain limitations by way of the Constitution in terms of free speech. But the state legislature doesn't go anywhere near that question of the corruption of political money mm-hmm. of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the major factors that makes our system unrepresentative.
Mm-hmm.
It's representative only of the money
mm-hmm.
and not of people and what's best for the country.
Mm-hmm. When you were in the House, in the State House, what was your contact with the university at that time?
Well, it was frequent. Uh-huh. Jack Breslin represented the university.
Okay.
Occasionally, would see President Hanna in my early years in the State House. Later on, of course, Hanna resigned as president and... Walter Adams was interim president. And then we have Cliff Wharton. I didn't get to know Wharton. I think about that time, what was Wharton's term?
1970 to 77.
Yeah, I left, factually, I left in, my election was in April 73, and I'd been campaigning
mm-hmm.
in 72 for the position. And so I had very little contact with Warren.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about Jack Breslin?
Well, Jack was the consummate MSUer. He was Mr. MSU, mm-hmm. and he dearly cared and loved the university. He made, I think he was so knowledgeable about the institution. And he wanted so much for the right thing to happen in the legislature towards the university. A lot of his issues went to question of financing, as they do now. The representatives of the university, public affairs people, legislative affairs people, they are so focused, and rightfully so, on the finances, because the legislature, under our Constitution, can do very little to affect the internal operation of the university. They do put some limitations on appropriations that probably are unconstitutional, but we haven't challenged them, neither have the other universities, because they haven't gone right to the heart of control. So Jack was a lobbyist, an ambassador of goodwill, a personal friend. We differed politically. Jack was, of course, a Republican working for Anna. You had to be a Republican. I think that it was during his years, as a consequence of the state income tax, the state had money. And it was a very different kind of a place from the first couple of years I spent there, which was kind of a log cabin legislature. And it's a consequence of George Romney, Bill Ryan, Jim Karrueb in the House also, he was a legislator. These are the people that negotiated the final package. On the Senate side, you know, I don't recall who spoke for the senators, who was part of that conference. I think this guy, a senator from Detroit, who was the majority leader, Denzel. God, it's been so many years. Mm-hmm. I haven't thought of him. Denzel, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And but there was no one on the Senate side that could hold a candle to Romney or Bill Ryan or Jim Karrueb. Mm-hmm. They really were knowledgeable on the details. And I sat there as a majority floor leader. And frankly, my contributions were minimal because my interests weren't in taxation or expenditures at that time. I had to be concerned with the flow of legislation and the type of legislation that would be coming to the floor. Some things we didn't want on the floor, other things we did. So I was a traffic cop. In many respects, I had to cajole the Democrat majority and move them, sometimes in they thought too fast, too much. One of them said after we lost the majority in the election of 1964, he said, "You did too much. You didn't leave anything on the plate that was unfinished." I said, no. This election demonstrates that politicians are really victims of circumstances in many respects. We had very fine people that were elected in the Lyndon Johnson landslide of 64. And here it is, 1966, and I want to correct myself. I said 64. Mm-hmm. I meant the election of 66, that we lost the control of the Michigan House. And, you know, the talented and gifted people lost their bid for re-election. They'd only served 2 years. Mm-hmm. It was a 747.
We didn't know the Mackinac Island Airport was so busy.
I know. Well, they've got a lot of people stacked up because of the fog.
Oh, yeah, they would. Jack Breslin's method of lobbying, would you say that was it anything different or special from what most lobbyists did? Obviously, he had a different interest, but...
Sure he did. And he was a gentleman, and... he really tried to deal with the facts. And he would also, for those of us who were MSUers...
he had a good list of those.
He had a good list. And he worked our heart. Uh-huh. I think with quite favorable results. I think as a consequence of John Hanna and his long association within the Republican Party. And you remember, he was the vice chairman, mm-hmm. along with George Romney, for the... the Constitutional Convention of 1963.
Yeah. Which was on campus. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
The presidents, do you remember any time when Hannah testified or when they came, or not testified, but when they came to the legislature and dealt with money issues or Horton also?
You know, it's hard for me to answer that because it wasn't on the Appropriations Committee, especially the higher education part
okay.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't comment on how often he came over or if he even did. I mean, I'm not that knowledgeable.
Uh-huh.
My areas were, in those 2 years, we were in the majority at that time. My areas were, as I've said, playing traffic cop and moving legislation. and I was interested in certain reform legislation that really hadn't been addressed in the previous years. I mean, it was a long list of bills that were enacted at that time, creation of the Arts Council, no-fault insurance legislation,
mm-hmm.
Reformation of workman's comp, of workmen's unemployment. These weren't extreme because we had a Republican governor,
mm-hmm.
but they were needed, necessary changes to those important social nets, and had been very, very contentious because of the opposition of kind of a Neanderthal business community. So consequently, there was a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Because principally in the 30 years preceding that legislature, nothing much had been achieved.
Mm-hmm.
We need mental health legislation. I think under Williams, there were certain steps that were taken to move the state forward with the help of five or six members of the House. They were basically young, they were called Young Turks. A couple of them I became acquainted with later after they'd left the legislature. One was Dick Smith from Bay City. Another chap was from Midland. Another was from Ann Arbor. They're just people of goodwill
mm-hmm.
who wanted to see the state come out of the Neanderthal stage and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So during the 2 years in which the Republican controlled, a fellow by the name of Bob Waldron was the speaker at that time. I was in sort of a neutral mode, found it hard to adjust to being in the minority after having worked long hours for 2 years and
mm-hmm.
been used to pulling the levers, and so I was sort of a silent. I took a seat on the Judiciary Committee, and when we came back into power in 1968, I became chairman of the Judiciary Committee, where I stayed until I left in 1973, resigned in 73 following my special election. I thought those years as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee were probably the happiest and the most productive of my legislative career. Wrote the state lottery law, state bingo law. We were involved in reforming the jury process, jury selection, no-fault divorce, a long list, reformation of the method by which you select county commissioners. They were then called supervisors. Some were appointed. It was all malapportioned. And we, during the first Democrat majority, the majority of the election of 62, that legislation passed, very important. But I was very, very satisfied with my work during those 4 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Had outstanding committee of Democrats and Republicans, people like Don Holbrook, Court of Appeals judge, Joe Swallow, who's a circuit judge, Jim O'Neill, Hal Ziegler. These were people who really liked the idea of working with ideas and draftsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
We were not just visionaries, but we were darn good technicians. We had an outstanding staff person Bruce Timmons. And Bruce has been with the legislature since came as an intern in 1962 while he was in law school. And he stayed on, and he became counsel to the House Judiciary Committee at a very, very young age, and served under Democrats. It was strange. It was the Republicans who kind of bounced him out.
Mm-hmm.
They moved him around. Moved him around and made him part of their central staffing, where he sort of gets lost. But Bruce was an incredibly gifted and talented person, or is. He's still, the good news is he's still with the legislature.
Mm-hmm. How was it that you came to run for Congress in a special election?
Well, it was an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been a child of circumstance and good fortune. And I think that, you know, in politics we say timing is all, but there's another factor, and that is good luck. And it was an interesting, very interesting story surrounding how I came to run. And I was with some friends on a Friday, TGIFing it, back in Bay City, and we were discussing the usual things about politics around our round table. And a friend of mine from the newspaper came in and said, "Well, you're going to run for Congress." And I said, I have no intention of running for Congress. He said, "Well," I said, "why are you asking? This is 1972, mm-hmm. and elections are a bit away now. Reapportionment had taken place, and I was pretty happy in the House of Representatives. And the district was a Republican district. And I didn't want to end my career by running against a Republican incumbent who no one was angry with,
mm-hmm.
and throwing away my future." And Dave went on to say, his name was Dave Rogers, Dave went on to say, "Well, we just got a wire story out of Washington saying that Nixon is going to appoint Congressman Harvey to the federal bench. And that will be in our paper tomorrow morning."
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
He planted the seed.
So my friends at the table said, mm-hmm. "Well, you got to run. It'll be a special election. You need to be a candidate."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "I haven't even considered that." And one of the chaps sitting there was my mentor. His name was Ray Kuhn. And he had been with the Bay City Times for a number of years and had just recently retired. He said, "Come on, we're getting out of here. We got to do press releases, call the television stations. You got to be on tonight announcing your candidacy." I said, "I think I'll be announcing Harvey's leaving." He said, "That's not the damn story. The story is you running. Don't forget that." So we went over to my home, mm-hmm. batted out a quick press release on an old broken down Underwood typewriter, called the TV stations, and asked to get on. And believe it or not, I made the 6 o'clock news.
Wow.
And I was announcing that the Republican congressman was going to take an appointment from the Republican president, and that I was a candidate for the vacancy. Nobody could believe this story.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was hot off my lips. Subsequently, I came to know that the Republicans believed for weeks that the Republican congressman, who was a moderate, had leaked this information to me and was sponsoring, in that fashion, my candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
And which was ridiculous, because the story really came out of a friend at the local newspaper.
Mm-hmm. So the president.
It was just hilarious the way it all played out.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Watergate matter. Dick Nixon came to the district campaign, mm-hmm. on behalf of my opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And
who was your opponent?
A fellow by the name of Jim Sparling. God, I haven't thought about Jim in years. Unfortunately, he's now deceased. But he had been Harvey's press secretary and administrative assistant.
Mm-hmm.
He had worked at the Saginaw News as a sports reporter. He had, matter of several, just a couple of months before, maybe five, gone over to the White House as a legislative affairs person, and he's working on this door. All in all, he had good credentials. He knew the issues pretty fairly well. And it was a spirited campaign, nationwide attention, international publicity. He had television crews from Germany, Holland, Scandinavia that came, plus the three networks here in the United States.
So there was, if his view was as a referendum on Watergate,
on
in some
Nixon,
respect,
correct.
On Nixon,
correct. Right. It was when I won that election, he never ventured out of Washington again.
Wow.
Now he became a captive of the White House, and by that time, end of April of 1974, he was simply trying to evade prosecution. And the next month he resigned, of course. I think it was first part of August. And the way I found out about his resignation was I got a call from Jerry Ford's office saying that Nixon had resigned and that Ford would be sworn in that morning in the White House and wanted the Michigan delegation to be present, and could I attend? And of course I said absolutely. And it was went over to the White House, and there were perhaps no more, well, there were no more than 200 people there, and the entire Michigan delegation was there, both the two senators, United States senators, and the members of the House. They had the House and Senate leadership, four from each body in the entire Michigan delegation, which I thought was most thoughtful of Jerry Ford. He was a wonderful, and is a wonderful human being, and he had many, many friends. He came out of that time when you could be friends. You could disagree, but you disagreed politely. You may be voting differently, but it didn't impact upon your personal relationships, which isn't, as we said, it isn't the case today. And so he had this gentlemanly courtesy about him and thoughtfulness when it came to members of the Congress. He was a decent human being.
That the tension in the room must have been...
What a historic event.
Yeah.
I mean, Nixon had already climbed on the helicopter and gave that famous wide sweeping of his arm farewell as he turned just before he entered the helicopter and went off to Andrews Air Force Base to fly to California and became part of history. And a few hours later, Jerry Ford was sworn in.
The during your congressional career, did you have any contact with the university, with Michigan State?
Oh, frequently. Frequently.
Well, how was there? Well, were you back on campus at all, or?
Yes, on occasion.
Usually
it was the vice president for research that would interface with me, but not always.
Was it probably John Cantlin?
John was the person who I first did. And then, of course, was the Cooperative Extension and the Ag School and John. So, there was a three-pronged attack. And I happened to serve on the Appropriations Committee and on the Agriculture Subcommittee, but it was interesting. John let me know, came to Washington to tell me that the question of financing a cyclotron. Let me think, wait a minute. Yeah, I think Michigan State has the, I think it's a cyclotron. And the department, at that point in time, these things were funded with from the Department of Energy. And they said that it was unnecessary, that there could be no original and creative research coming out of a cyclotron. And they weren't going to fund it. So I went to a friend of mine, Eddie Bolin, who served on the Energy Subcommittee of Appropriations, and explained to him that this was terribly important, and that this was a very essential matter for me. I think I perhaps stretched things a bit and said that it was necessary for my reelection. And he put it in the bill. Put I can't recall if it was 6 or 9 million.
Mm-hmm.
And it went forward.
Mm-hmm.
Came along. And that's how the cyclotron got started.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. There was another project that Gordon Gaia was responsible for, and he talked with me and my administrative assistant and the guy who followed my ag matters. He was really Mr. Agriculture, and that was Roger Shamrai. And Roger and Gordon became fast friends, as Gordon and I were and had been. Gordon was extremely helpful in my second election because I'd just been appointed to the Appropriations Committee. And Gordon got me together with some of the prominent farmers in several of the Thumb counties, and he was very, very, very cautious, of course. I mean, he wasn't into partisan politics. I was a congressman, and he wanted me to, in informal settings, meet some of the prominent agriculture types in Huron and Tuscola and Santa Fe.
Do you think it worked to your advantage that you were a Michigan State alum?
Oh, I think so.
In that election or in that
sure, absolutely,
location?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that my father had been a small farmer, a rural mailman. Nobody's mad at their mailman, especially
not very long.
not in those days, at least. So, I was in an ideal position because the other committee I served on funded the National Science Foundation, which is where John had a lot of interest. So I was able to be helpful. The food toxicology building was something that Gordon had spoke to me about over a period of years, and we kept asking questions and questions of the Department of Agriculture in terms of this issue and building a foundation to get the appropriation. And finally, I'd worked my way up a bit in the committee as well, and was I think a personal friend of the chairman, who I deeply admired, and he was a Southerner, Jamie Witt, remarkable individual. Towards the conclusion of my congressional career, we got the first appropriations for the building, and before I left, the building was fairly well locked in place. And it was interesting to come to MSU and participate in the groundbreaking. And then the dedication.
Yeah.
And they wanted to put up a plaque in the building, you know, so it fall upon. No, you can't do that. We're not going to have that.
Did, while you were in Congress, other than a couple of these, this situation in terms of contact, were there any other contacts with the presidents, President either Mackey or DiBiagio?
DiBiagio. came to Washington to speak to my subcommittee on the importance of funding for the National Science Foundation. And he was selected to do that because I was the chairman of the subcommittee. And so the other presidents appointed him as their emissary to plead the cause of more funding for the National Science Foundation.
So your alumni status back
then. It happened on that day. I was I had a conflict, and I couldn't chair the subcommittee because of the other conflict. So what I did was I came into the committee room. John was there waiting his turn to address the committee, and he knew that I wasn't chairing, obviously. And I asked him to step into my office in the off the committee room's floor, and. I told him I was very regretful that I couldn't hear his testimony. I'd read his prepared remarks and told him, you can be assured that this National Science Foundation will be well taken care of to the fullest extent that our finances allow. John was very distressed, and let it be known that he'd come all the way to Washington to
testifying before the chairman, mm-hmm. the chairman, not the vice chairman. Mm-hmm. I
was frankly somewhat amazed that he was so insensitive to the fact that Congress people can have conflicts, mm-hmm. and that you may be required in more than one place at the same time, and that you make your apologies, you make amends, and you try to explain to constituents that this unfortunately is the case. Well, I don't think there was any way you could persuade John that, mm-hmm. that there could be a conflict, that his presence commanded everyone else to be there. That was one of my first realizations of the egos of presidents, mm-hmm. university presidents. Mm-hmm. I always thought that some members of the House and the Senate had egos, but I soon discovered that it was a common phenomenon among academics. In fact, I almost told him to go to hell. But
when